Okay, over to you.
Hello, friends. Welcome to this 71st webinar on the Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. Let me real quick check my volume. It's good. Okay. This new version of Zoom likes to reset me at a very low volume. Anyway, this webinar series is available on Makara.us under the subheading Mori Federation's Webinars and Webinar Series in Progress. Previous episodes of this, The Secret Doctrine and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you'd like to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of morifederation.com, up in the upper left-hand corner. These provide hot links to the webinars, including Duane Carpenter's Awakening the Higher Mind. Okay. We are currently still in the chapter entitled The Bimbine Table of Isis, also known as the Mensa Isiaca. We began our last session with a brief review of the 15 triads that make up the Mensa Isiaca, the main body of it. We then took a close look at the eight qualities that encode the importance and meaning of these figures, which include form, position, gesture, the activity that they're involved in, their clothing, raiment, headdress, and staff. All of these give clues to the identity, the purpose, the relationship to other figures in the Mensa Isiaca. MPH then relates these eight qualities to eight spiritual senses of cognition, which he develops in his book entitled Spiritual Centers in Man. Quote, "These eight symbolic methods of portraying the secret powers of the figures are subtle reminders of the eight spiritual senses of cognition by means of which the real self in man may be comprehended." We then took a look at a chart that correlates Kircher's eight qualities here on the left side, which can be applied to each of the figures, with the eight spiritual senses put forth by Manly P. Hall. So if that's of interest to you, you can always pull up the last webinar series and webinar on this. Next, we take a look at the upper part of the elaborate border that surrounds the Mensa Isiaca, which includes numerous figures, plants, and animals, thus greatly expanding the tablet's subtlety and interrelatedness. We finish our last session by noticing the sunflowers in the four corners, noticing that they were symbolic of the consciousness of the disciples, since metaphorically they always keep their faces towards the sun. And this pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. We'll start off today's session with the last paragraphs of page 58 in the portfolio edition. So, could we get a reader, please?
I'll start us off today.
Okay.
According to the secret doctrine of the Chaldeans, the universe is divided into four states of being: planes or spheres, archetypical, intellectual, sidereal, and elemental. Each of these reveals the others, the superior controlling the inferior, and the inferior receiving influence from the superior. The archetypical plane, archetypal, sorry.
Archetypal, that's it.
Yeah, plane was considered synonymous with the intellect of the triune divinity. Within this divine, incorporeal, and eternal sphere are included all the lower manifestations of life, all that is, has been, or ever shall be. Within the cosmic intellect, all things spiritual and material exist as archetypes or divine thought forms, which is shown in the table by the chain of secret similes. In the middle region of the table appears the all-form containing personified spiritual essence, the source and substance of all things. From this proceed the lower worlds as nine emanations in group of three, the Ophionic, Ibiomorphous, and Nephtean triads. Consider in this connection the analogy of the Kabbalistic Sephiroth, or the nine spheres issuing from Kether crown. The 12 governors of the universe, the Mendesian, Ammonian, Mopthean, and Ompthian triads, vehicles for the distribution of the creative influences, and shown in the upper region of the table, are directed in their activities by the divine mind patterns existing in the archetypal sphere. The archetypes are abstract patterns formulated in the divine mind, and by them, all the inferior activities are controlled.
Thank you, Biel. Okay, first, according to the secret doctrine of the Chaldeans, the universe is divided into four states of being, planes or spheres. And these four are archetypal, intellectual, sidereal, and elemental. Each of these reveals the others, the superior controlling the inferior, and the inferior receiving influence from the superior. So, MPH is here using the secret doctrine of the Chaldeans to explain how the Mensa Isiaca, the chart we've been studying, encodes a four-tiered universe. The Chaldean system of planes or spheres of being is made up of the archetypal sphere, which is the realm of pure ideas, timeless blueprints for everything that is able to take form, that will eventually take form. And second, the intellectual sphere, the domain of divine intelligences who contemplate and draw life from the archetypes. Third, the sidereal sphere, which is the realm of stars, planets, and cosmic forces, where intellectual patterns are translated into celestial influences. And finally, four, the elemental sphere, the material world of the four elements, our physical plane, which receives the imprint of all the higher spheres. Okay, next, the archetypal plane was considered synonymous with the intellect of the triune divinity. So the sphere of perfect ideas and noumenal forms is that of the divine mind itself, which theosophy calls the cosmic mental plane. On the cosmic physical plane, this triplicity is downwardly reflected into Atma Buddhi Manas, then into the highest three subplanes of the systemic mental plane. Next, within this divine, incorporeal, and eternal sphere are included all the lower manifestations of life, all that is, has been, or ever shall be. So before anything ever takes shape on the cosmic physical plane, it already exists as a kind of eternal blueprint on archetypal levels. This is the Platonic philosophy of thought. It's a simplification of DK's teachings, which puts forth the existence of Dionys or creator gods on each of the higher subplanes of the cosmic physical plane, who work at the behest of the great Devic lords of those planes. and contradistinction, the Platonic has really just two planes, the archetypal and the physical. So that's the archetypal is where the true form exists in the which manifests in on our physical plane. Next, within the cosmic intellect, all things spiritual or material exist as archetypes or divine thought forms, which is shown in the table by a chain of secret similes. So, cosmic intellect emanates from the all-pervading mind of deity that underlies every aspect of existence, both visible and invisible. This intellect acts as the primal source, from which every form and idea is derived. The quote, chain of secret similes refers to the series of hidden visual analogies within the table, each link drawing a metaphorical parallel between a divine pattern and its material counterparts. You know, for instance, all these higher 12 figures, which represent the constellations, work out on the physical plane via these energies in the lower panel. They're directly linked one on one. Through these similes, seekers can trace back any manifest form to its originating archetype. Of course, the exact path through a given set of similes depicted in the Mensa Isiaca is not it's not given. It's certainly not in every case. There are some instances where it's Kircher talks about it, but generally it's left to our own intuition to identify and trace these connections, which is entirely possible with a deep study of this. Next, in the middle region of this table appears the all form containing personified spiritual essence, the source and substance of all things. So the central figure, which Kircher dubs the INX, symbolizes the highest of the four realms, the archetypal sphere of the Chaldeans, a realm of pure ideas and timeless blueprints for both the noumenal substance and living energy from which all forms, life streams, and phenomena arise. The divine idea underlying all things, as well as the living energy, which lives at the core of all of us, of all sentient life. Next, from this proceed the lower worlds as in the form of nine emanations in groups of three, the Ophionic, the Ibimorphous, and the Nephthian triads. So we have a structured descent from nine distinct realms, unfolding in three sets of three, each triad marking a particular level of cosmic manifestation. The first three emanations, called the Ophionic triad, form the vital and fiery ethereal realm, the initial intellectual world, called by Robert Fludd the Ethereum. Everything emanates from the central figure, but the first triad, you know, the one, the three from the one, is this energetic field represented by the these serpentine figures. Okay. So the central figure, sorry, which Kircher dubs INX, symbolizes the highest of these four realms. Next, from this proceeds the lower worlds as nine emanations in groups of three, the Ophionic, Hippomorphous, and Nephthian triads. So we have a structure to center nice dreams. The second three emanations, represented by the Hippomorphous, Ibis, as this is the Ibis headed god, therefore it's called Hippomorphous, are responsible for the intermediate domain of subtle forms where archetypal patterns begin to take shape. So pure energy on the highest, at the highest levels, and then the forms begin to take shape at this level. And finally, the last three emanations, called the Nephthian triad, represent the lower ethers, which are the direct cause of all that exists, of formative generation. Next, consider in this connection the analogy of the Kabbalistic Sephiroth, or the nine spheres issuing from Kether, the crown. So here's the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. The numbers work well, nine as three sets of three emanating from the one, but it's actually more philosophically accurate to include Kether and leave out Malkuth, which as the dense physical expression lies below the generative potencies of the three triads of the Mensa Ithiaca. Also, it's a better fit to associate the Ophionic triad with Kether, Chokma, or Kokma, and Bina. The Hippomorphous triad with Kesed, Tifereth, and Gibberah, and the Nephthian triad with Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. This is, you know, to really get the exact associations with each of these, is going deeper than we will here, but it's something that could be done. The following chart gives us further insight. So we'll go into it a little bit. So can we get a reader, please? Just read across the horizontally across the chart.
Catherine, can you read that for us, please? I guess not. Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. So we'll begin with the Ophionic serpent function and move to the corresponding Sephirah, the right. Key attribute, and then the elemental correspondence. So below that, we have the primordial unity, source point, corresponding to Kether, key attribute, divine will, elemental correspondence, spirit. Below that, we have the creative spark, the dynamic impulse, chokmah, creative wisdom, fire. And then we have the form-giving urge, reconciliation, bina, understanding, air.
So all these are connected with this first triad, this Ophionic triad, which are these two serpents and the sphinx-like figure below. And we could divide these three, two serpents and the sphinx, in according to these three attributes, right, which associate then with the Sephiroth shown here. Now we have no information about just which of these figures is which in terms of this function, but that's all right. We can, the idea is to get the sense of the triad. So, okay, for the next triad, which is called the Hippomorphic triad, can we get a reader, please? Same idea.
Michelle, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Ibimorphus serpent function, Zephyra, key attribute, water correspondence. Am I reading this correctly, horizontally like that?
Yeah, you want to read it horizontally
Okay.
across. It's sort of like, what's more effective? I think the idea is that as we follow along, we need to reread in our silently reread the top line in order to understand what just what it is you're talking about. But I don't think it's useful to reread it every time. So go ahead.
Okay, generative flow, fecundity, and overflow. He said, mercy, expansion, a fountain of living waters nourishing all. Sculpting and containment, form and law, Gabura, strength, discipline, riverbanks and dams shaping the water course. Meditation and synthesis, balance and unity, Tiprith, beauty, harmony, the calm heart of the stream harmonizing extremes.
Okay, so you could also read this vertically. This last column gives the best indication of the influence of these three, a fountain of living waters nourishing all, and then the containment through riverbanks and dams shaping these living waters, right? And then finally, the calm heart of the stream harmonizing the extremes that occur. Right, so that's another way of associating these three. Okay, and finally, for the third set of three, remember there were nine streams that came in through these three, and we're taking a bit of a closer look anyway. So, reader, please, this is pronounced Nephthian spirit function.
Ariane, please. I guess we lost her. Okay. Michelle, please. Oh, nope, you just did. Ron, please.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Chris.
Okay, left hand spirit function, correspondence, Zephyra, key attribute, elemental correspondence. So intellectual discernment, Netzach, victory, and air, analytical harmonization, the heart, splendor, and water. Is the element correspondence. Foundational support and transmission, Yesok, foundation and earth is the element correspondence. That.
Thank you. Okay, so this is just the, it's almost like the table of contents of a deeper study, right? It's just a way of penetrating into the nature of these figures, which is, their qualities aren't at all apparent on the surface. And so these allow us to go a bit further, especially through this corresponding with the Sephiroth, which we know more about, right? Okay, let's see here. Finally, the 12 governors of the universe, the Mendesian, Ammonian, Mophtian, and Ophtian triads, vehicles of the distribution of creative influences, and shown in the upper region of the table, are directed in their activities by the divine mind patterns existing in the archetypal sphere. The archetypes are abstract patterns formulated by the divine man mind, and by them all the inferior activities are controlled. So by the 12 governors, MPH is here referring to the 12 constellations that stand at the top of the chart. This is another chart that just reveals who these 12 governors are. They're not originators of the creative forces. The impulse is sourced through the central figure, that Isis figure. And then, but these transmit those forces from the divine mind represented by the central IYNX. Okay. Next, we turn to page 59 in the folio edition. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, and Veronica, can you read that for us,
By the way,
please?
anytime you have any questions, I'm sure you all know, questions, thoughts about any of this. If you don't understand something basic, fine, ask the question, because it's going to be another half dozen people that also don't understand that. So feel free to ask any questions anytime. Go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
One moment. Now you can hear me better, can you? In the lower region of the table are the father fountains of the Orion, Pandokian, Thaustic, and Auristic triads, keepers of the great gate of the universe. These distribute to the lower worlds the influences descending from the governors shown above. In the theology of the Egyptians, goodness takes precedence, and all things partake of its nature to a higher or lower degree. Goodness is sought by all. It is the prime cause of causes. Goodness is self-diffused and hence exists in all things, for nothing can produce that which it does not have in itself. The table demonstrates that all is in God and God is in all, that all is in all and each is in each. In the intellectual world are invisible spiritual counterparts of the creatures which inhabit the elemental world. Therefore, the lowest exhibits the higher. The corporeal declares the intellectual, and the invisible is made manifest by its works. For this reason, the Egyptians made images of substance existing in the inferior sensible world to serve as visible exemplars of superior and invisible powers. To the corruptible images, they assigned the virtues of the incorruptible divinities, thus demonstrating, what's that word? Arcanely,
Arcanely.
That, arcanely. That this world is but the shadow of God, the outward picture of the paradise within. All that is in the invisible archetypal sphere is revealed in the sensible corporeal world by the light of nature.
Thank you, M. Veronica. Okay, so first of all, in the lower region of the table are the father fountains, the Horian, Pandocian, Taustic, and Aloristic triads. Keepers of the great gates of the universe. These distribute to the lower worlds the influence descending from the governors shown above. So here are the four triads of the lower register, the cosmic quote-unquote gates that mark the boundary between subtler realm and the physical plane. MPH calls these triads the father fountains because, like springs at the base of a mountain, they feed the material world with divine energy. Here we have the upper register in direct relation to the lower regions. The 12 governors on top are the constellations, receive archetypal patterns from the IYNX, which stands at the center, and channels them, these archetypal patterns, to the father fountains below so that they can in turn nurture physical existence. Next, in the theology of the Egyptians, goodness takes precedence and all things partake of its nature to a higher or lower degree. Goodness is sought by all. It is the quote unquote prime cause of causes. Goodness is self-diffused and hence exists in all things, for nothing can produce that which it does not have in itself. So in the ancient Egyptian thought, goodness was the foundational principle from which everything was derived. It occupies the highest rank in their cosmology, meaning that every spiritual or material entity participates in goodness to a greater or lesser extent. Pursuing goodness thus becomes the universal goal for all beings, for goodness was seen not just as a moral ideal, but as the originating force behind creation. Next, the table demonstrates that all is in God and God is in all, that all is in all and each is in each. In the intellectual world and invisible spiritual counterparts of the creatures which inhabit the elemental world. So the phrase, all is in God and God is in all, echoes the Hermetic axiom of divine immanence. The supreme source permeates every level of being, yet remains infinitely greater than its creation. You know, having created a fragment of myself, I remain, that great Hindu statement by Krishna. The tablet portrays God not as a distant monarch, but as the very substance of all forms, sustenance and motion. The phrase, all is in all and each is in each, suggests that every part of the cosmos reflects and contains every other part. This isn't just a poetic idea. Rather, it's a blueprint for cosmic unity. It has a lot to do with the energy flow. If you can imagine these figures as discrete, that is, they do exist on their own plane and are separate, and yet they're the energy that comes from each of them is in a constant exchange with all the other figures within the table. Each symbol on the table, MPH here suggests, is a mirror of every other symbol. So not just the figures, but also the symbols, inviting the seeker to see the whole in every detail. The intellectual world refers to the realm of archetypal ideas or spiritual prototypes. Here live the true patterns, whether they be animals, rivers, stars, or gods. The elemental world, in contradistinction to the intellectual, is our material plane, where these prototypes cast their influence onto the forms of dense physical manifestation. Any thoughts or questions, comments? Okay.
Hold on. Sri Yantra Shanti says, I was wondering about whether in this table there is a correlation with Doth, the hidden seraph, Sephiroth.
I would, yeah, it depends on how you read the table. From one point of view, you could see Doth is sort of the, you know, it's the highest of the middle column before you reach into the primal three. Let's see, let me mark my place here so I don't go searching for it. Okay. And having done that, let me get out of here. We're on 51. Yeah, we'll go back to here. So you can see Doth's position here, which is, by the way, not recognized. And many teachings connected with the Kabbalah It's a more esoteric understanding of the tree of life. So, which is why it's kind of grayed out. But the idea is it's really the final bridge between the source triplicity, between the primal triad, Kether, Chokmah, and Bina, which are universal life, and then the breaking down of that life into the male and female components, which can be seen as spirit and matter at its highest levels. But then Doth forms the bridge that can be related to the figure at the center here, which is also a kind of intermediary, because she's not. She at IYNX, Isis, whatever you want to call her, is not the invisible pure spirit source of all. That's represented in this thing by her crown, which represents the, you could say that the crown itself represents the highest three sephira. And also the pure spirit aspect are these immaterial serpentine figures at the very top, which represent pure spirit fire. And then they're stepped down in two phases through these winged solar disks, which could represent the kind of, you could even look at this as cosmic mental levels descending finally to the highest level of the cosmic physical, which is the form-bearing level. She becomes the distributor, the one who determines the where these higher energies, where and how these higher energies will be distributed. And the way they're distributed is through these three triads, right, which we just read about. So yeah, I would say that she could represent, you could see her as representing Da'at, as that kind of place between the highest and the lowest. I'm no Kabbalah scholar, but that's one way that you could look at it. Okay, let's see, get back here to where next there.
And then she says, that is so interesting. Distribution of energy, the crown of Isis makes sense. Thank you.
Oh, good. It's always a perk when I actually make sense, you know? Okay, thanks for the contribution. These dialogue is always more interesting than monologue, so appreciate you stepping up. Okay. Let's see. All right, so next up, therefore, the lowest exhibits the highest. The corporeal, which just means form, declares the intellectual, and the invisible is made manifest through or by its works. I hope you're following this idea, this total integration of all these forces. So the lowest exhibits the highest means that the outermost, most earthly images, both in reality and on the tablet, reflect and reveal the principles of the central divine source. What appears to be merely physical is actually a living mirror of the spiritual. The corporeal declares the intellectual, same idea. It suggests that physical forms, whether animals, plants, or metals, act like almost like hieroglyphs. They speak of unseen archetypes, just as a lion stands for solar power. So every creature or object proclaims some idea or cosmic force. The invisible is made manifest by its works, suggests that forces and intelligences that cannot be seen show themselves through their effects. Thus, by studying nature's operations, growth, movement, transformation, the initiate glimpses the workings of the divine mind. Okay? Make sense? Okay, next. For this reason, the Egyptian made images of substances existing in the inferior sensible world to serve as visible exemplars of superior and invisible powers. To the corruptible images, they assigned the virtues of the incorruptible divinities, thus demonstrating arcanely that this world is but the shadow of God, the outward picture of the paradise within. So, ancient Egyptian artisans encoded spiritual truths by assigning symbolic meaning to the earthly materials that they used to make their quote unquote visible exemplars. Basically, every piece of spiritual art from ancient Egypt was designed with that in mind. To the corruptible images, they assigned the virtues of the incorruptible divinities, means that, for example, a bronze ibis did more than resemble the god Thoth. To the artisans and priests of ancient Egypt, it actually carried Thoth's wisdom. In the same way, a lotus motif evoked not just a flower, but the regenerative power of all creation. The subtext in all this is that our physical world is only the shadow of God, an outward projection of the true inner reality. And I think the reason that they used this Isis-like figure as the central figure in the table is that in ancient Egypt and Greece, in fact, all around the Mediterranean, Isis was seen as the figure who embodied all nature. She was the source of all outer manifestation, you know, what we call the Holy Mother or the Divine Mother. That really was the Isian God, however, because Isis was worshipped in all kinds of different forms all throughout Europe and all around the Mediterranean. She was one of the most prevalent gods. So I think that's probably the reason that they use her as that central figure in this tablet. Finally, all that is in the invisible archetypal sphere is revealed in the sensible corporeal world by the light of nature. So you see, he's saying the same thing over and over and over again from slightly different perspectives. So cosmic ideas don't remain locked away on their own plane. Rather, the same energy that fuels life in nature unveils those divine models within the world we inhabit. By attuning to the inner light, you know, meditating on a tree or a canyon or a mountain, we witness or we come into alignment with the living correspondence, the higher correspondence, and thus form a link between heaven and earth. Okay, any thoughts or questions so far? All right, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Catherine, can you read for us, please?
Yes, I can. The archetypal and creative mind, first through its paternal foundation and afterwards through secondary gods called intelligences, poured out the whole infinity of its powers by continuous exchange from the highest to the lowest. In their phallic symbolism, the Egyptians used the sperm to represent the spiritual spheres because each contains all that comes forth from it. The Chaldeans and Egyptians also held that everything which is a result dwells in the cause of itself and turns to that cause as the lotus to the sun. Accordingly, the supreme intellect, through its paternal foundation, first created light, the angelic world. Out of that light were then created the invisible hierarchies of beings, which some call the stars, and out of the stars, the four elements and the sensible world were formed. Thus, all are in all, after their respective kinds. All visible bodies or elements are in the invisible stars or spiritual elements. And the stars are likewise in those bodies. The stars are in the angels, and the angels in the stars. The angels are in God, and God is in all. Therefore, all are divinely in the divine, angelically in the angels, and corporeally in the corporeal world, and vice versa. Just as the seed is the tree folded up, so the world is God unfolded.
Thank you, Catherine. So, same message, right? He's expanding on this idea of the absolute interconnectedness. So, first of all, we have the archetypal and creative mind, first through its paternal foundation, and afterwards through secondary gods called intelligences, poured out the whole infinity of its powers by continuous exchange from highest to lowest. So he's really hammering home this point. The difference perhaps is the fact that not only does it move from the highest to lowest, but also from lowest to highest. It's a great energy exchange that is continuously going on in terms of the identity of all parties concerned, right? There's a complete infusion of self, of the self, the capital S self, in all. So all that is in the invisible archetypal sphere, as symbolized by the INX, the central figure, is revealed in the sensible corporeal world through the light of nature. It's the means by which the higher is revealed. Then during pralaya, that period of rest between cycles, nature is once again drawn back up into the bosom of the archetypal realm. Okay, the paternal foundation is the initial seed that generates all the levels that follow. It is singular, indivisible, and bears within it the potential for all multiplicity. The quote, secondary gods called intelligences are the Logoi, archangels, planetary spirits, and dhyanis who govern some particular realm or function, serving as a bridge between the pure mind and the physical manifestation. Okay, that's your questions. Next, in their phallic symbolism, the Egyptians used the sperm to represent the spiritual spheres because each contains all that comes forth from it. So, in Egyptian art and ritual, gods of creation and fertility, notably Min and Osiris, are often depicted with exaggerated phalli, a universal symbol of generative power, especially in the Mediterranean cultures around the time of Christ and before, representing the living fountain from which life issues. So the phallus was a pure symbol for this potent life force and the transference of that force. The Chaldeans and Egyptians also held that everything which is a result dwells in the cause of itself, okay, and turns to that cause as the lotus turns to the sun. So this is a description of the principle of immanent cause, wherein every effect or outcome already exists in potential within its originating source. When MPH says a result dwells in the cause of itself, he points to the idea that nothing truly new emerges out of nothing. Each manifestation is a flowering of what was secretly contained in its own root. Next. Accordingly, the supreme intellect, through its paternal foundation, first created light, the angelic world. Okay, the supreme intellect, represented by the INX and called by the Greeks nous, is the first and highest divine principle in Hermetic Neoplatonic thought. Through its paternal foundation, the world soul or archetypal matrix, it provided the nous, provided the organizing principle that molds raw potential into a blueprint for ordered existence. This downward transformation of divine purpose into the plan activates and organizes pure spiritual substance, here called the first created light, by means of the angelic world. This tiered realm of intelligences, each reflecting aspects of the divine mind that sent them forth, serve as intermediaries between the supreme intellect and the lower realms. The chart is basically a whole chart of intermediaries. Even the INX is an intermediary between the realms of pure spirit, formless pure spirit, and the many forms that exist within the chart, which themselves are intermediaries. There is no dense physical within the chart. Next, out of that light were then created the invisible hierarchies of beings, which some call the stars, and out of the stars, the four elements and the sensible world were formed. So from primal light emerge successive gradations or hierarchies, which include great solar logoi who precipitate their outer forms by means of the four elements. Next. Thus, all are in all, after their respective kinds. All visible bodies or elements are in the invisible stars or spiritual elements. And the stars are likewise in those bodies. The stars are in the angels, and the angels in the stars. The angels are in God, and God is in all. So the phrase after their respective kinds suggests interpenetration of influence without loss of identity, right? So every level of reality, material, celestial, angelic, divine, all contain both contains and is contained by the others. So, you know, that's this idea of the stars are in the angels in the angels are in God, and God is in all, is just two examples of how, of the absolute interpenetration of the essence of all these beings, but in accordance with their respective kinds, right? It's not a one-way flow, but rather a web of interpenetrating influences and existences. The four elements that make up the visible bodies of the lower four kingdoms of nature and the archetypal patterns that determine how these elements manifest have their counterparts in the constitution of the solar logoi that precipitate their outer existence. Angelic intelligences both spring from and at the same time sustain the solar spheres. Their energy and focus moves in both directions. Angels commune with as well as reflect the divine will. Next. Therefore, all are divinely in the divine, angelically in the angels, and corporeally in the corporeal world, and vice versa. So all are divinely in the divine means that everything, rock, star, angel, human, soul, has at its core, the same divine essence. God is not just out there, but stands as the inner reality of all things. Angelically in the angels, the angelic archetype, which is monastically animated, pure spirit, functioning in its third aspect, courses through every layer of existence, whether it be the soul of a star, the form aspect of a seed, or that which animates the structure of a crystal. Corporeally in the corporeal world means that the material principle interpenetrates, giving body and form to what might otherwise remain invisible. And vice versa underscores the fact that this mutual indwelling goes both ways. The divine is in the seed, and that which will eventually precipitate as the seed is in the divine. Finally, just as a seed is the tree folded up, so the world is God unfolded. So I had to play with this a little bit because to have a direct correspondence, this actually should read, just as the tree is the seed unfolded, so the world is God unfolded, in order to get a direct correlation. But we get the point. He said it now 50 times, right? And to make the interpenetration complete, we might add, thus seed, tree, and God are all one in essence. Okay, any thoughts or questions? I see a couple of chats. Let me take a look. All right, let's see here. Okay, so again from Sri Yantrashanti.
Yeah, the bottom two.
Yeah, okay. A Vedic mantram, Aum Brahmashmi, meaning literally, yes, I am that I am. It's the, which colloquially translates to I am in the cosmos and the cosmos is within me. And those are the key words of the Leo, right? I am that is a stage of becoming in consciousness, right? It's really the realization of, first of all, I am, right? Just that recognition of one's individual self is a stage of becoming that, you know, then it's expanded on when one realizes the much more profound stage of becoming, which is represented by the words, I am that. But finally, and at its highest level, you have, I am that I am, which is a recognition of the spirit aspect at the core of self. Thank you for that, Sri Yantra Shanti. Thank you. Okay. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Sure. Sri Yantra Shanti, can you read for us, please?
Okay, can you hear that?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Proclus says every property of divinity permeates all creation and gives itself to all inferior creatures. One of the manifestations of the supreme mind is the power of reproduction according to species, which it confers upon every creature of which it is the divine part. Thus, souls, heavens, elements, animals, plants, and stones generate themselves each according to its pattern, but all are dependent upon the one fertilizing principle existing in the supreme mind. The fecundative power, though of itself a unit, manifests differently through the various substances, for in the mineral it contributes to material existence. In the plant, it manifests as vitality, and in the animal as sensibility. It imparts motion to the heavenly bodies, thought to the souls of men, intellectuality to the angels, and superessentiality to God. Thus it is seen that all forms are of one substance and all life of one force, and these are coexistent in the nature of the Supreme One. This doctrine was first expounded by Plato. His disciple, Aristotle, set it forth in these words: "We say that this sensible world is an image of another. Therefore, since this world is vivid or alive, how much more then that other must live? Yonder, therefore, above the stellar virtues, stand other heavens to be attained, like the heavens of this world. Beyond them, because they are of a higher kind, brighter and vaster, nor are they distant from each other, like this one, for they are incorporeal. Yonder too exists an earth, not of inanimate matter, but vivid with animal life and all natural terrestrial phenomena like this one, but of other kinds and perfections. There are plants also and gardens and flowing water. There are aquatic animals, but of nobler species. Yonder is air and life appropriate to it, all immortal. And although the life there is analogous to ours, yet it is nobler, seeing that it is intellectual, perpetual, and unalterable."
Thank you. So, okay. So first, Proclus says, every property of divinity permeates all creation and gives itself to all inferior creatures. One of the manifestations of the Supreme Mind is the power of reproduction according to species, which it confers upon every creature of which it is the divine part. So this Proclus quote comes from Thomas Taylor's The Theology of Plato. FYI. So MPH here uses Proclus to confirm the perspective that he sets forth in the last many paragraphs, namely that the attributes we associate with divinity, goodness, intelligence, creativity, aren't locked away in some distant realm, but rather are part of an energetic interactivity that infuses every level of cosmos. All sentient life shines with these qualities because nothing can exist without both partaking of and emanating the life aspect. Proclus' statement on the power of reproduction underscores the fact that there is a divine source for the generative impulse in nature. Each species, oak trees, horses, humans, continues itself faithfully because the divine blueprint within it contains the template for its own likeness. It's interesting. We have some serendipity here because we're studying the same thing in the secret doctrine at this time, of how the difference between the spiritual continuation of these properties and the physiological, and how they impress each other. Okay, next. Thus, souls, heavens, elements, animals, plants, and stones generate themselves, each according to its pattern, but all are dependent upon the one fertilizing principle existing in the Supreme Mind. So the Supreme Mind doesn't micromanage reproduction in each realm, but it does provide the divine spark, that programmed quality to the divine spark that kindles new life into being in accordance with the blueprint for that species. We get a clue as to the aspects of this blueprint by studying the resulting DNA, but DNA only encodes the how of biological self-generation, not the purpose of the blueprint, and certainly not the nature of the spirit aspect that stands at the center of all sentient life. Since there's no DNA sequence that encodes causality, the fecundative power, though of itself a unit, manifests differently through the various substances. For in the mineral, it contributes to mineral existence. In the plant, it manifests as vitality. And in the animal, as sensibility. It imparts motion to the heavenly bodies, thought to the souls of men, intellectuality to the angels, and super essentiality to God. So each kingdom in nature uses the same divine fecundative power to express its own unique qualities. Let's take a closer look. The mineral kingdom represents the foundation of form and structure from which the higher kingdoms evolve physically. Its properties are density and cohesion and the basic building blocks of matter. DK calls it the depths from which supply must come. Levatsky teaches that the life wave of the mineral kingdom is the first to transfer to a new globe. How is the quote-unquote fecundative power different in the mineral kingdom compared to the plant kingdom? In minerals, fecundative power is present but latent. A crystal holds the blueprint for growth and structure, but it doesn't metabolize, grow new offshoots, or self-renew. In plants, the power to reproduce expresses itself through cell division, nutrient uptake, photosynthesis, and seasonal cycles, and thus adds vitality to that latent life aspect of the mineral kingdom. In the animal kingdom, we have the emergence of sensation and movement, right? All of these are demonstrations of the fecundative principle of spirit. So we have sensation and movement. This gives rise to instinct, perception, and the first stirrings of consciousness. The term psyche, which is Greek for soul, is not the overshadowing soul of theosophy, but, you know, spoken here in relation to the animal kingdom, but is rather the animating principle that brings life and responsiveness to the animal kingdom, to a sentient being. And heavenly bodies, In heavenly bodies, the quote-unquote fecundative power demonstrates through celestial motion. The positioning of heavenly bodies between the animals and the human souls, because you would think heavenly bodies would be after the human soul level, right? But this positioning in the chart reflects a cosmic bridge between instinctual life and rational consciousness. In Platonic thought, which is what MPH is here using, the celestial realm acts as a mediator, being more ordered than instinct, but less self-aware than human intellect. We're not talking about the planetary, the different logoi, those inhabiting spiritual beings, but rather with the anima mundi, that universal animating spirit that mediates between the higher and the lower spheres, between the intellect and sensible realms, but doesn't include the great cosmic beings who inhabit those celestial bodies. And the soul, overshadowed human being, the fecundating potency, demonstrates as nous, intellect, and rational thought. In Neoplatonic thought, angels are considered to be the very essence of thought itself, living embodiments of perfect ideas, each reflecting some specific divine attribute. They function as cosmic molds, channeling these archetypes into all the kingdoms of nature. This is a bit different than the theosophical model, but the theosophical does embrace the idea that angels represent the nous aspect, the source of intelligence. Okay, next up. Thus it is seen that all forms are of one substance and all life of one force, and these are coexistent in the nature of the Supreme One. So the Supreme One not only creates the living matrix of every atom, but is itself one with this living matrix. Thus, nothing is separate from its source. Next, this doctrine was first expounded by Plato. His disciple Aristotle set it forth in these words: "We say that this sensible world is an image of another. Therefore, since the world is vivid or alive, how much more then that other must live? Because they contain elements of the ageless wisdom, the broad outlines of Plato's doctrine existed long before that Greek master's incarnation. But Plato did reintroduce these ancient principles to the West." I mean, you would have found very similar ideas in Hinduism long before the Greek era, but he codified these ideas for the West. MPH here tells us that Plato distinguishes between a changing, perceptible realm, the sensible world, and an unchanging, archetypal realm, the intelligible world. He holds that what we see and touch is merely a vivid copy of perfect eternal forms that exist beyond sensible perception. Again, this varies somewhat from the theosophical model, which is actually a more complex, layered understanding, not just an A, B, you know, understanding. Next, Hall gives us some examples of higher correspondences to physical plane reality. I actually thought he was quoting somebody here without citing it, but evidently these are actually Hall's words. "Yonder, therefore, above the stellar virtues, stands other heavens to be attained, like the heavens of this world beyond them, because they are of a higher kind, brighter and vaster, nor are they distant from each other like this one, for they are incorporeal. Yonder too exists an earth, not of inanimate matter, but vivid with animal life and all natural terrestrial phenomena like this one, but of other kinds and perfections. So this statement by MPH aligns more closely with Neoplatonic thought than with classical Platonism, because it implies a gradation of successive levels of reality rather than the pure dualistic division between archetypal and physical realms, characteristic of the Plato school. Finally, there are plants also, and gardens, and flowing water. There are aquatic animals, but of nobler species. Yonder is air, and life appropriate to it, all immortal. And although the life there is analogous to ours, yet it is nobler, seeing that it is intellectual, perpetual, and unalterable. Here MPH describes the Platonic archetypal realm, which stands as the source of the material world. Note that he still speaks in terms of specific shapes and spatial reality, whereas theosophically, on higher levels, separative existence is progressively transcended, ultimately resolving into a blaze of pure spirit beyond thought, form, or separation. Whereas in the Platonic model, the form world was just taken to a higher level. It was considered archetypal perfection, right? And that was it. That was the God realm. Okay. Oops, I missed one there. Okay, next up, we get a reader, please.
Yes. Selena, can you read that for us, please? Selena?
I cannot because I have so much background noise.
Okay. All right.
Sorry.
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, I can. For if anyone should object and ask, how in the world above do the plants, etc., above mentioned, find footing? We should answer that they do not have objective existence, for they were produced by the primal author in an absolute condition and without exteriorization. They are therefore in the same case as intellect and soul. They suffer no defect, such as waste and corruption, since the beings yonder are full of energy, strength, and joy, is living in a life sublime and being the issue of one fount and of one quality, compounded of all, like sweet savors, delicate perfumes, harmonious color and sound, and other perfections. Nor do they move violently about, nor intermix, nor corrupt each other. But each perfectly preserves its own essential character. They are simple and do not multiply as corporeal beings do. Unquote. In the midst of this, the table is a great covered throne with a seated female figure representing this. We saw that here. But here called the Pantomorphic, INXGR5. Mead defines the INX as, quote, a transmitting intelligence, unquote. Others have declared it to be a symbol of universal being. Over the head of the goddess, the throne is surmounted by a triple crown, and beneath her feet is the house of material substance. The threefold crown is here symbolic of the triune divinity, called by the Egyptians the supreme mind, and described in the Zephyr HaZohar as being, quote, hidden and unrevealed, unquote. According to the Hebrew system of Kabbalism, the tree of the Sephiroth was divided into two parts, the upper invisible and the lower visible. The upper consisted of three parts and the lower of seven. The three unrecognizable Sephiroth were called Kether, crown, Chokmah, wisdom, and Bina, understanding. These are too abstract to permit of comprehension, whereas the lower seven spheres that came forth from them were within the grasp of human consciousness. The central panel contains the seven triads of figures. These represent the lower Sephiroth, all emanating from the concealed threefold crown over the throne. It's kind of interesting to me to read this because of how the church translated it and declared this was revealed by God itself directly in the Bible. It's beautiful to bring what has emanated into human consciousness all together in a kind of a flow. I wanted to say that, Francis, because I know you've been calling for questions, and it isn't for me about knowledge, though I got a master's degree in religion at Columbia. It was so off, and all I could do was rattle around saying, can't be this, it can't be this, it can't be this. And this is that what we're having here is everything that I had just thought was, you know, possible, that there would be a flow of reality that makes sense, you know, with all the words and language and complexity. It's so simple.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
Yeah, it is. You could, you know, there's a lot of words here in these last many paragraphs, but there's a simplicity at the core of it, this interflow, this interconnectedness that happens between the higher and the lower without them losing their identity. You know, there's just, it's a great teaching, I think. Neoplatonism, you know, if you're attracted to this, that's basically that's what MPH is giving us here, and he's using the table of Isis as a way of charting the Neoplatonic thought. Okay, first, for if anyone should object and ask, how in the world above do the plants, etc., above mentioned, find footing? We should answer that they do not have objective existence, for they were produced by the primal author in an absolute condition and without exteriorization. So again, MPH describes the archetypal realm where, of course, there's no objective existence and therefore no need for footing or nutrients, right? Second, they are therefore in the same case as intellect and soul. They suffer no defect such as waste and corruption, since the beings yonder are full of energy, strength, and joy, as living in a life sublime and being the issue of one fount and of one quality, compounded of all like sweet savors, delicate perfumes, harmonious color and sound, and other perfections. I especially love this last phrase, you know, that this essential unity is a compound of all sweet savors, delicate perfumes, harmonious colors and sounds, right? It's all of those qualities held in what's the word I want? In potential, right? And yet having those qualities as potential within itself. So MPH here associates archetypes of the natural world with the realm of the intellect and soul in order to stress their incorruptibility. Here, vitality isn't just biological, it's a perpetual, exuberant force. These beings, issue of one fount and of one quality, suggest atmic plane origins, the realm of undivided spirit. Okay. Next, nor do they move violently about, nor intermix, nor corrupt each other, but each perfectly preserves its own essential character, and they are simple and do not multiply as corporeal beings do. So archetypal forms cannot be altered by external forces. Preservation of quote unquote essential character means they remain exactly what they are eternally. This contrasts with embodied life, where cells die, traits mutate, and individuals age. From a theosophical perspective, the material in these last few paragraphs conflates the nature of existence on the higher planes, describing qualities of the physical etheric, such as an idealized mirroring of the outer form, the higher mental plane in terms of union with the soul, and the atmic plane in terms of issuing from one fount, having one quality. But Platonic thought doesn't seem to have codified these graded distinctions, instead dividing reality more simply into the archetypal and the physical. Next. So we once again move back to the Mensa Isiaca. In the midst of the table is a great covered throne with a seated female figure representing Isis, but here called the pantomorphic INX. G.R.S. Mead defines the INX as a transmitting intelligence. Others have declared it to be a symbol of universal being. G.R.S. Mead's description of the INX as a transmitting intelligence suggests a kind of divine antenna that projects thought forms or archetypal patterns into the lower realms. The latter represented by the enclosure beneath the lower realms here, the INX's throne. The name INX can be traced to both a bird, also called the Eurasian wryneck, but also the INX, and to a handheld magical spinning wheel called the Wheel of Hecate, Hecate being an aspect of Isis. Like this wheel, the central figure of the Mensa Isiaca suggests boundless motion and change, cosmic energies endlessly interweaving rather than the static, compartmentalized gods and goddesses found in other parts of the Mensa Isiaca. Next, over the head of the goddess, the throne is surmounted by a triple crown, and beneath her feet is the house of material substance. The threefold crown is here symbolic of the triune divinity called by the Egyptians the supreme mind, and described in the Sefer HaK Zohar as being hidden and unrevealed. Okay, we can see here a kind of cosmic axis from the hidden transcendent source represented by the triple crown, all the way down to the world, manifest world below, represented by the enclosure below the throne. The Sefer HaZohar describes the ancient Holy One as having, quote, three heads which are united in one. Next. According to the Hebrew system of Kabbalism, the tree of the Sephiroth was divided into two parts, the upper invisible and the lower visible. The upper consisted of three parts and the lower of seven. The three uncognizable Sephiroth were called Kether, the crown, Chokmah, wisdom, and Bina, understanding. So here's the above described Kabbalistic tree of life, which we often refer to in this and the Secret Doctrine webinar series. Kether represents pure essence, Chokmah, the divine idea, and Bina, formative understanding, with the emphasis on the formative aspect. The lower seven represent the subsequent stages through which spirit inhabits progressively more dense levels of form until you get down to our physical earth and Malkuth. And finally, I'm going to finish up this, even though we're right at the hour here. Finally, these are too abstract to permit of comprehension, whereas the lower seven spheres that came forth from them were within the grasp of human consciousness. The central panel contains seven triads of figures. These represent the lower Sephiroth, all emanating from the concealed threefold crown over this throne. So Kether, Chokmah, and Bina exist in a realm of pure abstraction, beyond all form, concept, and sensible image. Because they're incognizable, they remain hidden under the threefold crown above the throne, and are never given any kind of distinct iconography. Whereas each of the seven triads in the Mensa Isiaca, which are emanations visible to mind and soul, correspond to one of the lower Sephiroth. And that's going to do it for today. We'll pick up here and next time. We're coming towards the close of this chapter, just one more page after this. So do we have announcements for?
Yes. Okay. Next up is Treaties of Cosmic Fire on 12 September. And then the next Secret Doctrine, that because of the new moon and the full moon, both the Secret Teaching of All Ages and Secret Doctrine for September were blown out of the water. So the Secret Doctrine is going to be on the 28th of September. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages gets us back on schedule on the 5th of October. It will be at 6:30, which is a little earlier than normal because of some other conflicting things. But that's what we've got coming up. So,
thank you. So either heads up or warning, depending on how you take it, I will be conducting not only the pre-full moon, but also the full moon meditation itself, which Tuya usually does, but she, lucky her, is with a Vietnamese group in Tibet. She's flying down there today, I think. So she asked me to pick up on that full moon meditation. So hopefully you'll join us for that. By the way, you can always just go to MauriFederation.com to pick up on this schedule if you forget these times. Okay, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Take care.
See you, everybody. Bye.